Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, Alfred Saad Filho returns to update us on the political and economic crises in Brazil. And then at the bottom of the hour, Dibyesh Anand will talk to us about India's brutal repression of protests in Kashmir. First, Alfred Saad Filho. He was last in his show in April, just after the lower house of the Brazilian Congress, the Chamber of Deputies, voted to begin impeachment proceedings against President Dilma Rousseff on very shaky grounds. She has now been convicted and removed from office. Rousseff was a successor to the immensely popular and skillful Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, leader of the Workers' Party, known as the PT after its initials in Portuguese, who rode an economic boom and brought millions up from poverty through generous social spending. Boom has turned into bust, and Rousseff turned rather unpopular. But the motives for the impeachment were entirely political, the upper class's resentment to the PT, a coup in constitutional guise. Here's Alfredo Saad Filho, who teaches political economy at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, to explain all. President Dilma Rousseff has been kicked out of office, right? What happens now?
Technically, President Temer has taken office, and he should complete the term of office for which Dilma Rousseff and himself as vice president were elected for. In 2014, the term of office goes until 2018. So he's got a little over 2 years to do what he has set out to do, which is essentially focusing on fiscal restraint, with the ambition of taking Brazil out of the deepest economic contraction anywhere, I think, in the world, and certainly amongst the middle-income countries at this point in time.
So he's going to give us austerity in the midst of an economic collapse. This is what Keynes would call depression economics, isn't it?
This is precisely true. The only major policy initiative that the provisional administration has taken in the past 3 months while President Rousseff was being judged by the Senate, the only thing the administration has done is to propose an amendment to the Constitution imposing a nominal freeze in public sector spending. And this is popular amongst the economic orthodoxy, popular amongst most of the capital, financial capital and industrial capital in the country, but you're absolutely right. This is exactly the opposite of Keynesian economics or any form of heterodoxy, and it is unlikely to work unless Brazil gets an economic kick from the rest of the world through the devaluation of the exchange rate and additional exports.
Now, when the U.S. led the world into recession with the financial crisis of 2007, 2008, you know, into 2009, we also helped lead the world out with a fairly large stimulus package that was quickly reversed, but it did give the economy a kick for a couple of years. That lesson has been lost on the Brazilian government?
One, they've never learned the lesson of anti-cyclical economic policy. And two, politically, there are gains to be made by pretending to be very, very orthodox and to say that you're doing the opposite of what the administrations led by the Workers' Party did. Now, the pretext for removing President Rousseff is precisely fiscal impropriety in the sense of excess fiscal spending or inappropriate fiscal spending. So coming into office with the aura of orthodoxy and being very trustworthy with public finances is politically desirable at this point in time. So there is an element that is just political gimmick, but there is also an element that some of these people actually believe that fiscal orthodoxy is good and the market will find in itself the energy to take the economy out of an extremely deep hole.
Before we proceed, you alluded to the charge against Rousseff being fiscal impropriety. The charges, to be clear, were completely trumped up and nonsensical, weren't they?
They are trumped up and nonsensical, yes. The entire case against President Rousseff hinges on two things. One is public spending without authorization by Congress, and that was proven to be inappropriate in the sense that every single previous administration in Brazil had done exactly the same thing. The other part of the accusation is that the federal government used implicit loans by public sector banks to fund fiscal spending, particularly an agricultural subsidy program and social policies. Again, that has been disproven extensively by the Ministry of Finance, the previous Minister of Finance himself, and by the auditors, the public sector auditors, too. And disproven to the extent that these particular accusations did not play any role in the actual case against President Rousseff as it was presented by the politicians in the Senate. Their entire focus of the case against the president did not hinge on the legal issues, but it hinged on the fact that the president had lost parliamentary support and that her administration had led the country into this current economic crisis. Now, there were political mistakes, and Dilma Rousseff is far from being a very good politician herself, but these are not impeachable offenses.
Yeah, and the people who led the charge against her are just up to their necks in ethical troubles, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely, including President Temer. President Temer, this is absolutely curious, President Temer cannot be a candidate to the presidency in 2018 because he has been implicated in scandals of corruption. He has lost the judgment in the court and he's lost the appeal. Because you lost in two instances, you become ineligible according to Brazilian law. So he cannot run for the office that he is now in charge of, which is absolutely bizarre. Yes, corruption is deeply ingrained in the Brazilian political system. This is how the political system functions. It has always been like this, and corruption at this particular point in time has been used politically to destroy the power of the Workers' Party to impeach Dilma Rousseff, and the next stage will be to use accusations of corruption to try and imprison former President Lula, and even more important than putting him in prison is to make him ineligible so he cannot run for the presidency in the next elections in 2018.
Now, I read on Twitter, which it may not always be the most reliable of sources, that the two people behind Temer in the line of succession are also under ethical clouds. Is that correct?
This is correct, yes. And a large chunk of members of Congress, possibly more than half, maybe up to two-thirds.
This is a political system and an economic system that's in really deep structural crisis. This is not just some political melodrama. This is the real thing.
This is the real thing in the sense that it has become very clear that it is not possible to have a stable political system of rule in a country that functions with the constitution that Brazil has that distributes power very widely. It is a decentralizing constitution that is at the same time based on a presidential system. The president does not have the capacity to run the country in a stable manner when Congress is so powerful and Congress is at the same time heavily divided. At this moment, 28 political parties have got representation in Congress. And no party has more than 20% of the seats. So it is impossible, and it has always been impossible, for presidents to govern without broad coalitions. And the way to stabilize coalitions is through pork barrel politics and through corruption. That's how the system works. So it is impossible to pretend that by prosecuting one accusation of corruption after the other, you're going to clean up the Brazilian political system. It is impossible to do this. The system is institutionally distorted and corrupt.
That system you described sounds not unlike the United States. We have two parties, not 28, but you know, all that that kind of gridlock seems sort of familiar to an American.
I should think so, yes. I think features are different between Brazil and the United States, but I think the dysfunctionality is something they do have in common.
Stepping back to the bigger political picture here, the reason that these forces have been going after Dilma Rousseff and now also, as you say, going after Lula to get him in jail and ineligible to run again for the presidency. There's a real element of class revenge here, right? The Brazilian ruling class hates the Workers' Party, even though the Workers' Party was a fairly mild social democratic organization in power.
This is absolutely correct. And since the elections in 2014, when the political right wing thought they were going to win and then suddenly found out that they had lost, a decision was made at the highest levels of politics that they would overthrow the president. She would not be allowed to govern. And Dilma Rousseff suffered an incessant attack on the media and across all levels of politics to make her administration unviable, to the extent that she became very, very isolated politically. And yes, in fact, if she had won today, it would have been very difficult to imagine how she could actually govern the country, because she just does not have the political base of support. And the entirety of the mainstream media is completely against Dilma and what she represents, which is the project of power of the Workers' Party. This mild social democratic set of reforms, looking for industrial policies that would lead to some form of developmentalism, some very mild social reforms in the country, very moderate distribution of income and distribution of power. This project ran against increasing resistance by capital and by the upper middle class. And it is this social alliance, as you mentioned, that blocked this project, overthrew the president, and they are now going to exercise almost unlimited power in the country.
Let's review the achievements, the positive achievements of the Workers' Party. They were limited, but they were actually, the very poor in particular, had some income gains during the period of the Workers' Party rule, correct?
This is correct. Brazil experienced in the past 10 to 15 years the most sustained process of distribution of income in recorded history. It is traditionally, as most Latin American countries are, a country of extreme concentration of income, extreme social inequality. That changed a little bit. The country introduced social programs that became platforms for inspiration for many other countries in the world, supporting the very poorest. Now, these were very limited social programs that never costed very much money, particularly the Bolsa Familia program that supported children in very poor households. That cost 0.5% of GDP. But it was extremely successful in lifting from absolute poverty a very substantial chunk of the population. So absolute poverty declined from about 20% of the population to 5%. Now, this progress has been halted during the past year because of the economic crisis and because of the political turmoil in the country. And it is not going to be resumed. This is exactly the kind of social change that the new administration wants to stop. And they absolutely want to restore the kind of social order that existed previously, a social order where poor people knew where they belonged and they would not trespass in the social spaces that were not rightfully theirs. This is the kind of inequality that is behind the political project of overthrowing the Workers' Party.
I'm speaking with Alfredo Saad Filho of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. I believe the last time we talked, you emphasized how the Brazilian rich and the upper middle class felt personally insulted by the changes in daily life wrought by Worker Party rule, right? Could you talk some more about that?
This is absolutely transparent to anyone who goes to Brazil, who visits the country and who speaks to people, both poor people and upper middle class people. Since the transition to democracy in Brazil in the late 1980s, there has been a feeling of citizenship that evolved in the country and has been growing and grew very substantially under the Workers' Party administration. We are equal by virtue of being citizens of this country. So we are fundamentally the same rights and the same privileges as citizens. This was a feeling that never existed before in Brazil. Since colonial times, society has been based on very large and fundamental inequalities and social differences and in social deference as well. Under the Workers' Party, for good reasons and maybe not so good reasons, consumption increased a lot, wages increased, levels of employment increased, and there were avenues for consumption that were not open before. Poor people started to occupy spaces in shopping centers, spaces in airports, buying cars with very long installments, 72 months, sometimes even longer than that, and they were allowed to use their social policy, the benefits that they would receive from government, as collateral to obtain bank loans, which they could then use to buy things, to buy consumer goods and to buy housing and so on. This, again, contributed to a sense of self-esteem that wasn't there before. And this was not acceptable to richer people in the country. This was absolutely clear to anyone who goes to Brazil and speaks to people, the sense of trespass, the sense that you do not belong here. You shouldn't even be here. You should not be in this particular space. And it is common. People who live in other very unequal countries will recognize these symptoms. It is similar to what happens in South Africa. It is similar to what happens in other very unequal countries in the world. And this particular political project now that has led to the impeachment of the president is a project of restoration of some measure of that inequality. What we will come to see in the next few months is whether the new citizens will accept, or to what extent will they accept, having been thrown back to positions that they thought they didn't have to tolerate anymore.
And this came even though the wealth and prerogatives of the rich weren't really stepped on very much by the Workers' Party, were they?
No, not at all. It is very clear that what distribution took place was a distribution from the upper middle class to the workers. The very rich, the top 1% of the population, did not lose anything in the past 15 years. But the 9% or maybe the 19% underneath the top 1%, immediately underneath the top 1%, they lost a little bit of income, and they lost a lot of social status and social differentiation. And both things made this particular social group extremely hostile to the Workers' Party. So for the first time in 50 years, there is an organized right wing in Brazil now, an ideological and organized right wing that is extremely hostile to the left, to the Workers' Party, to any form of income distribution. And this is very significant loss for the cohesion of Brazilian society and the cohesion of the political system.
People from the 80th to, say, the 98th percentiles are not the majority of society, but they're large enough to create something like a popular movement.
This is correct. Once you have a lot of influence on the media, once you have a lot of influence in parliament at different levels of government in states and municipalities, and so on, once you are in control, in actual control of the judicial system, because your social group commands the judicial system, then you have a lot more power than pure numbers would suggest.
So what now? They got rid of Dilma, but they now have a government that has no legitimacy, is deeply corrupt. What can they do from here?
Challenge for this government is to stabilize itself politically, to gain some legitimacy. They do have a majority in Congress, but there are very important fractures in the parliamentary base of this particular government. And I think the first fracture that will come to the fore is between PMDB, the party of President Temer, and PSDB, the traditional party of right-wing opposition in Brazil. The two parties are in an uneasy coalition in government right now, but there are conflicting power projects between these two organizations. The next challenge is, from the point of view of the left, can the left actually bring out the contestation that they have been threatening the government with for the past several months? There have been a number of demonstrations in Brazil, but not the level of dispute against this parliamentary and judicial coup that the left aspired to generate. Can they do this now? And if they can, there will be continuing political instability in Brazil. If they can't, then instability will come from the right-wing coalition in power. Brazil will have a very, very difficult period of time ahead of it in the next 2 years. And there is no indication that the economic crisis will be magically resolved anytime soon. The economy might improve because it has bottomed out, but it will be a very slow improvement.
One of the shortcomings of the Workers' Party government was that they really didn't transform the economy in any meaningful structural way, right? It's still very commodity-based, and when the commodity boom evaporated, so did the Brazilian boom, right? There's no strong fundamental base for a turnaround.
This is correct. I think the most important characteristic, of its administrations was that they always pursued the line of least resistance in society, in the economy, and in everything else. So it was a reformist administration, but it never confronted any significant interests. And one of the consequences was that Brazil specialized in what it could do already well and cheaply, which was the export of commodities. Deindustrialization advanced. The country lost an enormous number of jobs and a very significant part of its manufacturing base. So it is very difficult to see where the next 10 or 20 million jobs are going to come from. The country lost about 10 million jobs in the last year or so. Where are these jobs going to be created again? Where is the dynamism, the energy, the drive going to come from in the economy? Now, if you look at the difficulties in China and the growth slowdown, the continuing stagnation in Western Europe, and even in the United States, so external demand is unlikely to create dynamism. And even if it did create dynamism in Brazil, agricultural exports are not labor-intensive. They do not create lots of jobs. So the economy is in a very serious structural problem that comes from decades past, and the Workers' Party did not confront, but now the problem is worse, and it's in the hands of the new administration.
What effect, if any, did the Olympics have on the political economy of the country?
Essentially none. There was some investment in Rio de Janeiro in particular, and an attempt, the Olympics were an excuse to try and regenerate large sections of the city of Rio de Janeiro that has been in decadence for several decades. And that was an injection of pride and of money into the economy of that city. But other than this, no. Brazilians in general were skeptical about the Olympic Games. They were happy with some of the results that Brazil itself achieved in terms of the sports. But the Olympics should not have any lasting impact either on the economy or in the politics of the country.
So it sounds like the outlook is fairly bleak for the next, for as far as one can imagine it, really.
This is correct. It is difficult to see where the country is going to find the economic drive and how it's going to find economic stability. Society is more divided than it was before. And politically, I have been following Brazilian politics for a few decades now. I have never seen the country so deeply divided, and it is very difficult to see how it can be healed again.
And this is all a further symptom of the recession of the pink tide that was, for a while, something hopeful happening in Latin America.
This is correct, and the pink tide has retreated almost everywhere. Venezuela is in very deep trouble, Argentina has elected a right-wing president, etc. But the biggest defeat, I think, is in Brazil, because Brazil is a member of the BRICS group of countries. It is by far the largest economy in Latin America. The Workers' Party offered an inspiration for political parties of the left around the world and an alternative political project, and now it is gone. The removal of President Rousseff is the capstone in the whole process, but the Workers' Party itself was in many ways a disappointment, in the sense that they did not confront the inequities of the political system in Brazil, that they pursued the line of least resistance everywhere. They did not reform the media. They did not reform the land tenure in the country, etc. So it was an insufficient project from the point of view of reformism, but even then they were attacked and they are under threat of being terminally harmed, mutilated, possibly even destroyed in this process.
All right, that's great. Thank you very much.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you.
Well, great to talk to you, as always. Maybe we'll have something more cheerful to talk about someday.
Hopefully someday soon.
That's Alfredo Saad-Filho, who teaches political economy at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the second movement of the first string quartet by the Italian composer Giacinto Scelsi. Next, Divyesh Anand on Kashmir. Kashmir, about which most Americans, including me, know very little, is considered the northernmost region of South Asia. It's divided into areas ruled by India, Pakistan, and China, a product of British imperial cartography when the departing imperialists created India and Pakistan in 1947. The situation in Kashmir has never pleased the residents, but their respective masters have not relented in almost 70 years. Divyesh Anand is a professor of international relations at the University of Westminster in London, who is now in Kashmir. It's not easy getting a connection to that part of the world. We tried Skype at first, which was fraught with problems, and switched to a cell phone, which was better, but still not great. My apologies. Here's Divyesh Anand. Welcome. I have to admit that I know very little about Kashmir, and I'm sure most of the listeners don't know very much either. So let's start by with the history of the region. It's quite a cultural crossroads and a lot of disputed territory. How did we get here?
When we went, the modern nation states of India and Pakistan were created in 1947 after the formal end of British colonial rule. There were certain princely states that were not part of either Pakistan or India, and Kashmir was one of them. Most of the scholars or media focus on Kashmir as a disputed territory between India and Pakistan. So some are, and of course parts of Jammu and Kashmir, that's a state, Jammu and Kashmir. Part of Jammu and Kashmir state is with Pakistan, part of it is with India, and some part which is largely unpeopled is with China. In 1947, when India and Pakistan, of course, were formed, at that is the time when there was a war between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, and Kashmir, rather than being given the option of independence from both, was forced to, and this was the thing, the Hindu ruler of Muslim majority Jammu and Kashmir was forced to join India, forced because there was a tribal invasion from Pakistan's side, and of course there was also a revolt against him from the parts that were later controlled by Pakistan. So broadly speaking, there is a history of formation of new nation states. Second, smaller states in the region like Jammu and Kashmir not being allowed right to self-determination and being forced to be part of India and Pakistan. Now, one thing which India did, and also Pakistan agreed, they went to United Nations and promised a plebiscite where the people of Jammu and Kashmir would be allowed to decide between India and Pakistan. And this is important to note because they didn't give an option of independence. This both India and Pakistan agreed. But even that plebiscite hasn't happened since 1947.
And what are the feelings of the population? Would prefer to be part of Pakistan, prefer to be an independent country? Certainly there seems to be no sentiment to stay with India.
No, see, this is the thing, because when we talk of Kashmir, we have to keep in mind that one-third of Jammu and Kashmir is with Pakistan. There are two different regions there. And they have their own dynamics of politics. So when we talk of Kashmir conflict today in international media, it's largely about the Indian-occupied Kashmir rather than Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. Now, of course, if you say Indian-occupied Kashmir in India, that itself becomes illegal because India says that entire Jammu and Kashmir, including those controlled by Pakistan, legally belong to India. Now, even within Jammu and Kashmir, which is controlled by India, parts of it, there's a diversity of regions. There are regional differences, there are sectarian differences, but overwhelming feeling amongst people is of not being part of India because India is misruled, right? And misruled in the region, and there have been gross human rights violations, especially since 1989. So if, and this is a personal and my research-related view would be that majority of people may want to be independent from both India and Pakistan, but there's also strong pro-Pakistan constituency, and the reality, they may also be pro-India constituency. But most of the people talk of Azadi, which implies freedom.
Well, how did the Chinese figure out to do this?
There is a part of Jammu, erstwhile princely state of Jammu and Kashmir, that was disputed by India and China. So India and China has a long border that's also disputed. There are different parts of it. So Indians accuse Chinese of occupying parts of Jammu and Kashmir. But as I said, it's uninhabited, so there are no people there. And the reason China controls that part, which is called Aksai chain, is because, and it goes back to Tibet, because the only way in which China could control Tibet from 1951 onwards was building road from what is Xinjiang today to Tibet, and that went via what is north. So China's stance is one related to borders dispute with India. The second thing they do, of course, is one of the policies of China is to sort of pigeonhole India as a South Asian power rather than an Asian power. So by supporting Pakistan, they make sure that India remains always in tension with Pakistan.
There's been an upsurge of protest recently. What started it? What's it all about?
For the last 53 days, the people of Kashmir are living in the siege. When we talk of siege, we essentially imply long hours of curfew and long hours of strike. So people can't go out on the street. People get killed. It started with the killing by India, and that was an extrajudicial killing of a militant who was fighting against India, Burhan Wani. He was quite popular, and he was seen as sort of a very popular figure amongst youth. He was around 23 or 24 years old. He used social media, including Facebook, to propagate his message, and his message was largely that he is not a terrorist, his organization is not terrorist, but it is Indian state that's committing terrorism against Kashmiri people, right? It was his killing, and because he was very popular, that led to this round of, uprising.
Instead of handling the protest in a proper manner, what Indian armed forces, that included army, police, and paramilitary, they killed a lot of unarmed protesters. There's a cycle, therefore, of protests, killing by the armed forces, and further protests. The last 53 days, Kashmir has witnessed a siege, which includes curfews, complete restrictions, and killing of around 70 people, blinding of 200 children, and injury of more than 30,000 people. This is the immediate conflict. But what we have to keep in mind is that this uprising is not unique in itself. This is part and parcel of a longer battle that Kashmiris have been fighting, and that's a battle for resistance against Indian colonial occupation. And they have been doing that since 1947, and there have been different phases. Some have been armed insurgency, some have been largely unarmed protests. But in both the cases, Indian response has been the standard. That is use of overwhelming force. They've used murder, they've used extrajudicial killing, they've used enforced disappearance. 8,000 to 10,000 Kashmiris have been disappeared since 1990, and India is refusing to, sort of account for them. There have been cases of mass rape of women. There have been cases of sexual torture of men. So all kinds of violence have been used by Indian state, and this is well documented through Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, everyone else. And this lies at the heart of disconnect between Kashmiris and Indians. That is essentially, for Kashmiris, India is a colonial occupier. For India, Kashmir is a territory that they cannot leave.
Why is India so determined to hold on to Kashmir?
Well, one, of course, is territorial, and India is, like most post-colonial states, is rather neurotic about its territory. It is about, you will not give an inch. So India claims that Kashmir is an integral part of India. Integral would imply that without Kashmir, India cannot survive. And now this is the Indian stance. So they would never talk of Kashmir being an integral part of India. They'll talk of Kashmir being an integral part. So India has a territorial vision of nationalism by which basically they will not give up on Kashmir. So when, for instance, Kashmiris protest against India, the Indian response usually is, apart from the violence that they use, for Kashmiris to say, you go to Pakistan. If you don't like living in India, go to Pakistan. That's a very odd kind of rhetoric that Indian nationalists use. They use that against any critic. So what lies behind it is, of course, is control over resources. Kashmir is rich in resources, especially in hydropower, right? So that's the resource part. But largely, I would argue, it's not about resources. It's not about territory. It's about certain vision of nationalism that is a colonial version of nationalism, which is that this is my country, right and wrong. All the territory that belongs to me will belong to me, and anyone that opposes or calls for democratization in the region, he'll oppose them.
It sounds like the Indians learned their approach to territory very well from the British.
They did. See, that's it. If you talk of two Indian nationals, they always define themselves against British. But India is a very strong and good, and it's a good, not in sarcastic sense, good inheritor of British colonial system. The difference is the British even could not have that authority over the periphery of Indian Empire, the way in which modern post-colonial Indian Empire is having over the territory. By the way, it's not only about Kashmir. It's also about what India calls northeastern India, including Nagaland and Manipur. So India is facing challenges there. One thing, for instance, apart from use of violence, India also uses rule of law. And this is where the struggle is. When we look at, for instance, Tibet or Xinjiang, or we look at Baluchistan in Pakistan, we could see that there the occupying power is not, either in case of China, not democratic. In case of Pakistan, at least it's a democracy from time to time. Now, India's biggest weapon and tool is the fact that it's called world's largest democracy. So, if, for instance, if you criticize India on Kashmir, they'll say, but we are world's largest democracy. And this is a very paradoxical situation where democracy is used by people to gain more power from the state. But in India, democracy is used by the state against the people of Kashmir by saying that you cannot criticize us for human rights abuses we are committing.
And what has the BJP government done in relation to Kashmir? Has that intensified the problem?
In Indian context, not Kashmir. In Indian context, there's a big difference between, let's say, the left and the center and the right. When I say big, of course, there's always a shade because neoliberalism is now common to all of them. But there is a shade of opinion. There are differences. But when it came to Kashmir, the reality is BJP is not that different from Congress, which was secular nationalist. Because both the secular nationalist Congress and the left, by the way, and the right wing, which is BJP, they have a common stand, which is Kashmir is an integral part. The only difference might be that the left may say we should at least allow human rights to Kashmiri people and we should not kill them. The Congress will be better at using words to assuage sentiment, and BJP is very clear there will be no compromise. So with BJP in power, and it's not BJP in power, it's BJP under Narendra Modi, who was responsible for killing of more than 1,000 Muslims in his own home state of Gujarat, right? And he won despite that. So he had that arrogance. His party has the arrogance that Indian people will not bother about Muslim minority. So the fact that Kashmir is Muslim majority, as well as one that Indians will see as secessionist, makes it double whammy for them, and it allows BJP to sort of justify the policy in Kashmir. But there is one difference, by the way, compared to what Congress did in the 1990s, which is when there was an armed uprising. In 1990, there was an armed uprising against India, right? And yet, there was no popular mobilization of Indians against Kashmiris. And that is something new under BJP and under Narendra Modi. Last 2 years, the level of hatred, the level of popular mobilization against Kashmiris is unprecedented. So, for instance, today, Indian armed forces might be killing 70, but Indian right-wing Hindu nationals are calling for massacre of more Muslims to teach them lesson. And that's a big difference.
Asugath Debyesh Anand, who is a professor of international relations at the University of Westminster in London.
You mentioned armed uprising several times. How does that fit into the picture? How long has it been active? Are there different groups? Who are the cast of characters?
Since 1947, there have been a lot of opposition against Indian rule in Kashmir. That has been the case since 1947. But there were various other demands. There were demands for Pakistan. There were demands for plebiscite. And then there was a general acceptance because there was no popular mobilization at that point in time. That, okay, maybe a genuine autonomy within India might work, at least for some of them. But what happened was since 1989-1990, there was an armed uprising. That had part of the connection was because Indian democracy that was given chance by Kashmir for many years failed completely, because what India would do is they would remove any elected leader who would not toe the line of Delhi. So basically Kashmir rose up and Indian army responded, and then there was an armed uprising. But armed uprising phase would largely be between 1989-90 to 2002. Now, today, since for the last 7 to 8 years, even by Indian estimates, Indian government estimates, there are between 300 to 400 armed militants in the valley. Only 300 to 400. And yet, India has put 700,000 armed forces in valley. So you could see very fact that they are justifying the presence of 700,000 military, paramilitary and others in the valley on the grounds of the 300 to 400 militants. Because what has happened now, of course, there's a perverse incentive in Indian structure that army benefits from being in Kashmir. The conflict is a good industry. Through conflict, what you have is army and other armed forces, they benefit. And one other thing we have to keep in mind is that there are special laws in place. There's a particular law, for instance, Armed Forces Special Powers Act. That is an emergency law. Now, this is a law which, let's say, Assad used in Syria. So these are the kind of laws which they are supposed to be temporary. India has had that law in place in, that act in place in Kashmir since 1990, in Northeast in India since 1950, which essentially allows full impunity to armed forces. So for instance, if armed force personnel is accused of rape, of murder of unarmed civilian, you cannot take them to court without the permission of Ministry of Defense. And since 1990, zero permission have been granted by Ministry of Defense.
It sounds like the current uprising, which has been going on about 2 months, has been met with extreme violence on the part of the Indian forces. The thing that made the front page of the New York Times, without much exploration of the politics behind it, were the number of particularly young men who've been blinded by the pellet guns. What are the Indian forces doing? How are they approaching these rebellious crowds?
See, when you speak to Indian armed forces, of course, they'll speak with very forked tongue. So any loss of life is regrettable, but we had no option. Like, that's how they justify. That's what they'll justify officially. Now, in 1990s, the way they justified large-scale massacres was by saying that we were not prepared for armed insurgency, right? That's how they justified. But today, they can't even claim that they were not prepared for any kind of protest because Kashmir has been protesting for decades, so they can't justify that. What has happened, of course, is because armed forces have impunity, they know that they can get away with it. And that is at the heart of what we find today. So even when they knew that the militant they had killed through extrajudicial methods was very popular, even in the protest, and these are largely unarmed protests, by the way, I said, they're not even militants protesting. These are unarmed people, and most of the people who have been sort of blinded and killed are young people. And in that context, they will justify excess of what Indian media will call excess, they don't call excess force, they'll just say reasonable force. The armed forces will justify by saying that they had no option because the protesters were in large numbers. But the reality, of course, is because of impunity, they know they can get away with it. And they also know that the largest section of Indian population still consider them to be heroes because they see Kashmir as anti-national and those who deserve to be killed.
In the current round of protests, are there demands? Are there organizations? Is it spontaneous? What's the nature, political nature of these protests?
Right now I'm in Kashmir, and this is my observation, this is my reading, and this is my understanding. But Indian government will say that the entire uprising was because of Pakistan, now, which is a very odd kind of argument. Because one, they will say Pakistan is not popular, it has no relevance. And Kashmir has an elected government, which is a coalition, by the way, of a party, Kashmiri party called PDP. It's a pro-India party and BJP. So they'll say there's no pro-Pakistan feeling. Then they blame everything on Pakistan. Then they say it's only 5% of people who are protesting, 95% people are peaceful. It's like they keep changing the stand. But in my own reading, the basic thing is much of it is spontaneous, right? Much of it is. But of course, because 53 days have gone, what we find is, of course, young people coming together and there's a strong sentiment for Azadi. Azadi essentially means freedom. Now, of course, if you ask them exactly, does Azadi mean joining Pakistan? Does it mean freedom from India alone? Does it mean freedom for both India and Pakistan? That will be divided. But at least everyone agrees, almost everyone, that first and foremost, you have to stop human rights abuses. Second, you have to realize that Kashmir is not a dispute between India and Pakistan, but Kashmir is a matter of self-determination for all people of Jammu and Kashmir. And that is what we have to keep in mind. So even internationally, when you look at New York Times or Guardian covering it, they focus on human rights abuses. But what they don't focus on is it's not a dispute between India and Pakistan, but it's a dispute between India and Pakistan while erasing the political agency of all people of Jammu and Kashmir.
What has Pakistan's reaction been to the uprising? Are they just standing back and watching or rooting it on, cheering it on, or how are they approaching it?
See, again, with Pakistan, what was interesting is, because, of course, in 1989-90, it was very important factor in supporting armed rebellion. That's why it was important. But since 2002, and especially since 9/11 and other things, Pakistan decided to withdraw that support, armed support, for simple reason, because Pakistan is an ally for U.S., right? So that's what had happened. Now, in 2008, 2009, and 2010, when there were, again, protests, large-scale protests, unarmed protests in India, Pakistan was largely silent. In 2013, when India hanged a Kashmiri on a very flimsy ground and said that, and Supreme Court of India said that there's no tangible evidence against him on grounds of terrorism, but to satisfy the collective conscience of the nation, he has to be hanged. Remember, so to satisfy the collective conscience of a democratic nation, a person has to be hanged. That was a Kashmiri person, Afzal Guru. They hanged him. Even that point in time, Pakistan made some statement, but not that. This time is different. This time, Pakistan, once the uprising started here, right, they've been talking of support of self-determination, and they are now sending envoys to around 22 different countries to highlight the issue of Kashmir. So they're going to do that. And the reason for that is twofold. One is because Pakistan, as you may know, has its own internal crisis. It has its own problems. And therefore, this is one only reality, the only issue on which the right and the left and the center, the military and the civilians, agree is on Kashmir. So they are using Kashmir sort of to solidify their own position in Pakistan. So it's sort of easy for them to do it. But when we look at Pakistan's position in Kashmir, it's very odd that the Pakistan-controlled Kashmir, which they call Azad Jammu and Kashmir and Gilgit Baltistan, right? Even there, the constitution of that region makes it very clear that there is no support for independence. They will only allow those who hold constitution power in those positions, those who support accession with Pakistan. This is the problem with Pakistan. They do support, they claim to support right to self-determination, but for them, right to self-determination is UN resolution, which essentially implies India and Pakistan. Right? For India, of course, they don't even do that. So because India has been so rigid and so draconian on Kashmir, Pakistan's position comes across as more benign than Indian position. But the reality is in both the cases, there are different forms. One is more militarized, second is less militarized.
And the United States, what is Washington's attitude?
Washington's attitude in 1950-60 was to talk again, say that basically because as Washington became more closer to Pakistan, they put pressure on India to sort of resolve the Kashmir issue, but that was never resolved. And since 1990s, and this was the Cold War era, in Cold War era, because India was seen as closer to USSR and Pakistan closer to US, so the US would talk more of Pakistan. But since 1990, and specifically since early 2000, US and India have been working more closely together. While, of course, even Pakistan is seen as an ally of the US. So U.S. position, like the position of European Union, has been to keep out of it and say it has to be resolved between India and Pakistan. In that process, what they do, of course, is they become complicit with human rights abuses in Kashmir. So, for instance, today, even when U.S. says that, India and Pakistan should talk to each other and resolve, the reality is talking to each other would not resolve anything because the main position is, of course, of military colonization of Kashmir. Unless you allow and encourage Kashmir on board as an equal between India and equal amongst India Pakistan, you will not resolve the conflict. And sadly, while Washington's position is becoming closer military ally of India, while of course also being military ally of Pakistan and not caring much about human rights abuses and denial of self-determination for Kashmiris.
Okay, so where do you see us all going? I mean, India has substantial force on the ground, hundreds of thousands of troops and paramilitary. People have rocks, basically, in a small armed rebellion. How do you foresee this developing?
See, this is the interesting thing. In the 90s, there was a proper armed rebellion, right? But now it's not even armed rebellion because everyone protesting and you see them, they're women, children, and they're largely young people. And even older people joining, but younger people. And none of them armed, of course. The only thing they're armed with occasionally is stone. So stone pelting is a common method of protest, right? Now, of course, stone pelting, one could see even from the state's perspective, the way to deal with that would be even if they have to fire, they fire at the foot, not at the body. But almost all the killings that have taken place using live bullets have been the head or an upper part of the body. So what we find, therefore, is a large use or a significant use of sadistic violence by Indian troops. And the reason, again, is because they know they can get away with it. So the way I see, of course, is Indian government has made it very clear they don't care. Prime Minister Modi, who's known for tweeting here and there about everything in the world, except when there's a violence against Muslims in India, violence against Kashmir in particular, talked about love of India for Kashmir. And when you talk of love of India, essentially love of India is expressed through pellet injuries, it's through blinding and other things. But what we find is, and I personally think, and in my reading, I don't see an armed rebellion in the region because there's no one supplying arms. And Pakistan, this is unlikely to supply arms to people, right? So there's no appetite for armed rebellion, but there is a complete disconnect with India because there's a strong realization that essentially India is a colonial power that's not going to change. So it's largely going to be a situation where India will try a policy of divide and rule, and that's what they've been doing. So So what they'll do is they'll try to promise certain things to certain people and not others. They'll try to do that. But India is playing a waiting out game, essentially hoping that Kashmir will get exhausted beyond a point. But at this point in time, and remember, Kashmir has very harsh winters, and winters will be coming from November itself. So maybe Indians are waiting for that period where Kashmir will sort of wear out. But the point is, even if this round of protests subsides, even if like they might protest subside, it doesn't imply that people will start liking India. It essentially implies that the disconnect with India would be even more complete. And there would be another round of protests, another round of uprising. Even next year, this year is not unique. As at 2013, it happened. 2010, it happened. There are frequent rounds of uprising, and all of them unarmed, because they're only either unarmed unless you count the stones as arms.
That was Dibyesh Anand, a professor of international relations at the University of Westminster in London. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of power pop from 1984, and an antidote to lots of bad news. Toutes les nuits by Les Calamités, sometimes described as the French Go-Go's. Till next week, bye. Je comprends, tu as recommencé, car t'entendais pas là où tu réjouis.